I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, The Gift of Giving.
People want to own their passions. In other words, they want to touch and feel and affect the change themselves, put their hands on it, to put their arms around it, and to see tangible short and long-term impact on where they put, I call the three W's, work, wealth, and wisdom.
My guests today are Don Muller, Executive Director of the Marcus Autism Center, Janice McKenzie Creighton, CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Metro Atlanta, David Axford, a little brother in Big Brothers Big Sisters of Metro Atlanta, and Lisa Moore, intellectual property attorney and former executive director of Georgia Lawyers for the Arts, a nonprofit that gives free legal advice to artists.
So if you look at Atlanta and you look at Georgia as a state in comparison to other places, we rank number 6th according to the Journal of Philanthropy in the total dollars, the net dollars that people from Georgia give away to help support charities and other related events. And I think the root cause of that is the success the city's had. If you look at the number of corporations that have started here, Home Depot, UPS, other major corporations, Coca-Cola,
yeah.
I mean, you can't deny the fact that there's a lot of wealth in this town. But the nice things about people here in Atlanta is they put their money to work and they invest back in the infrastructure and the not-for-profits, and it really has made a huge difference in this town. The other thing is that people in this town give money in a smart way. They don't just give money away to causes. They do it to try to change the future. Bernie Marcus is a great example. He doesn't just shower money towards everybody that comes and asks him for money. He has a strategic plan. He invests in things like the aquarium, not just to build a nice fish tank, but to help drive economic development. And a lot of folks in this town really approach philanthropy in a strategic way.
Let's tell the listener who you are and about your dual roles.
Sure. My name's Don Muller, and I'm a vice president of operations at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, but I'm also the executive director for the Marcus Autism Center. We're the largest clinical center taking care of over 5,600 kids a year. That's 5,600 unique individuals with autism or related disorders. We are set out to do something very different in the world and to really make a difference in the lives of kids with autism.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the history of autism and then individuals who work there with you all, research, you know, nurses, the whole picture.
Sure. The history of autism really parallels that of many developmental disabilities. And to be honest with you, it's not a great history. There's things that have happened, segregation, different types of structures where our society really felt like the best thing to do was to basically warehouse individuals that weren't typical or neurotypical. Same thing happened with a lot of retarded citizens. The reality is that we're doing much better today. We're helping people achieve the best that they can do. And what we've learned through applying science is that many individuals who are on the spectrum can actually get much further in life if we intervene early. So early intervention is the key. And becoming aware is the first part of early intervention. I think we've done a great job nationally of making autism a household word. And as a result, kids today are getting treated earlier than ever before. Unfortunately, the average age of diagnosis for autism is still 5.5 years of age. And we know there's a critical window of time where we can really maximize the outcomes for a child. Today, most insurance companies don't cover autism. Most kids need 25 hours worth of intensive care or intensive therapy in order to maximize their outcomes. But unfortunately, we just can't afford it. The state can't afford it. Individuals can't afford it. Private insurance companies can't afford it. So what we're trying to do is create community viable programs to help train folks on how to take care of autism. That involves working with the public school system. It involves working with Babies Can't Wait, with Head Start, and really with the parents to build these very viable models. The great news about Atlanta is we've got a city where people like to work together. so you can get folks to sit at the table and have those conversations. And if you believe that everybody inherently coming to the table with good solutions and they want to work together, you put a child in the middle of the equation, you really can solve the world's problems.
There are a lot of worthwhile causes out there. Why did Bernie Marcus choose autism? And also, second to that, what's your personal vested interest in it?
Sure. Bernie was approached by an employee, an accountant that worked with him back 1990, 1991. And this woman said, "I can't work for you anymore, Mr. Marcus. I've adopted a child. The child has autism, and there's no care here in Georgia." Bernie observed this. He watched what this woman went through, and then he decided he was going to make a difference. He called down to Emory to see, you know, who he could get to take care of this child, and there wasn't anybody. So he literally bought two double-wide office trailers and put them down at the Department of Pediatrics at Emory and hired a developmental pediatrician who began working with that child. That's grown into what we have today at the Marcus Autism Center. Bernie is the most passionate individual when it comes to philanthropy, and he gives his money in a very wise and strategic way. He saw an opportunity to really get involved and change the future for people with disabilities here in the state, and he's accomplished that. There are many diseases out there that have great needs. Autism has a great need, mostly because insurance companies don't pay for it. One out of every 84 children born in the state of Georgia will be affected by autism. That's three times the rate of all childhood cancers combined. If you had a child with cancer and your insurance company said they weren't going to pay for it, you'd be devastated economically, emotionally, and you'd be pissed. The reality is that most people get that message from their insurance companies when it comes down to autism.
I'm sure you've seen a lot of tough days. What keeps you going and motivated, and how do you go home at night after one of those tough days and just get back the next day and assume that passion?
Sure. Leadership in healthcare is hard, and it's hard because you see people at their worst and most vulnerable times. Having said that, you also see them at their best times. You see the victories. You see kids begin to get better. You see kids say their first words. You see kids starting to eat again. You see kids who can, you know, speak and participate in society and become a normal kindergarten. You know, I see kids who come in at three who cannot speak and are destined to live a life of seclusion and really live a life of isolation. We can take these children by early intervention and teach them how to say words and how to communicate.
As a leader in healthcare and in the nonprofit sector, where do you see Atlanta, you know, going in the future? Where are we 10 years from now?
The reality here is Atlanta has some amazing leaders, and there's great leadership infrastructure. I see the city really leveraging itself to do great things, and I see a lot of reinvestment potential. As long as we have the Bernie Marcuses of the world and the Whitehead Foundation and the Woodruff Foundation and Coca-Cola and UPS, Atlanta is destined to do things that no other corporation, no other city, no other state can do. We've got some of the best minds in the academic organizations, Emory, Georgia State, Georgia Tech, University of Georgia. If we all continue to work together, Morehouse and others, we can really continue to change the future. And it doesn't happen haphazardly. It happens through leadership, through strategy, through strategic planning, and really putting the kids first. But as part of what we're doing in the future, what we need to do is think differently to extend our reach out into the communities. If you look across the state of Georgia, half the kids live in Atlanta. The rest of the kids live spread out all over the state, and there's no other town with more than 120,000 kids in it. When you've got very precious resources, it's hard to put high-end resources in every town. And to be honest with you, you probably don't need to. You don't need a transplant program in every town. You need those kids to travel here to get that care. So it's really about specializing and then leveraging. Telemedicine, it's a great thing. It's going to be the new wave of the future for taking care of kids in rural Georgia. This is a great town. We have a lot of good things going on, and there's a lot of money in this town that's being applied strategically towards our goals, not just at Marcus Autism Center, but at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and really in all of these not-for-profits that are doing good work. And thankfully, the internet's bringing a lot of resources to help people grade where they should give their money. You want to give towards organizations that are going to show you a good return on your investment. And there are a lot of not-for-profits in this town that are really doing that.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Gift of Giving, brought to you by Perkins and Will.
When people talk about mentoring, there are any number of things that come to mind, but as relate to Big Brothers, Big Sisters, mentoring is a very definitive thing, that it really is about a one-to-one relationship, that moves and engages children in such a way that their lives are changed for the better, and we like to say forever.
You're listening to Janice McKenzie Creighton, CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Metro Atlanta.
One of the things that, after so many years of trying to be a voice for Big Brothers Big Sisters, I've come to know that while a child's life is changed, a whole family's life is most often changed. And also the volunteer's life has changed. And so it's just the most positive way to affect, through this one act of friendship, the lives of so many. What I'm finding after being here so many years now, I'm able to see that legacy manifest, that one big brother and little brother, the little brother then grows up and becomes the big brother. And so we're now in, I'm seeing second and third generations of bigs and littles now. And so it's so interesting to see how that has developed.
One thing that I've seen become increasingly more important is how real estate and the built environment is becoming a part of the brand of image and of programming. At Big Brothers Big Sisters, what's been created in this house?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, I'm so proud of it. It's just been such an amazing opportunity and experience for us. And that's at the corner of 17th and Peachtree Street in one of the last remaining mansions on Peachtree Street that is then connected to a 3-floor office building. When we moved to that facility, 47% of our matches at that time were male matches. And you know that one of the things that is always close to our hearts is the fact that little boys wait too long to be matched. And that's for any number of reasons. But in Big Brothers, Big Sisters, up until very recently, the majority of the matches we were making, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, were female matches, the majority of new ones. And now it's 53% male.
What do you attribute that to?
Visibility. That we sit right in the heart of so much activity. Law firms and consulting firms and, you know, investment firms, and the traffic, the foot traffic alone is amazing.
I haven't really thought about it this way before, but it makes sense, at least in the case of Big Brothers Big Sisters, to be able to give back and do more for the community, really being visible in the community, and in this case, through a physical structure, just real estate, it has been important.
It has been. And, you know, we have real designs on the number of children we want to serve in this community. When I came there 21 years ago, we were serving 800. And last year, we ended the year serving well over 3,000. If there are 300,000 kids that need us, and I'm barely getting to 3,000.
Is that how many in Atlanta that need it?
Mm-hmm. Metropolitan Atlanta, yeah, wow. 300,000. So we know we can't do it all. Just no way. You can't build a boat big enough for that. But you can work with other organizations that you can share practices. I've been talking with my good friends at United Way about how is it that an organization like Big Brothers Big Sisters that knows mentoring better than anybody can help smaller organizations that want to get in the mentoring business, right? The research says that you need at least 18 months for it to take, for that relationship to take, for there to be positive impact. And anything less than that starts doing damage, all right? That if you're not in the life of a child for at least 18 months, you stand the risk of doing more harm than good, because one more adult that didn't show up, one more program that promised and didn't deliver.
Who I am, I mean, I'm I'm 17. I'm a high school student. I'm a varsity athlete. I'm the executive officer at my in my ROTC unit. I mean, I'm a little, so my involvement with the Big Brothers is mainly just limited to, you know, just hanging out with my big and everything.
And how long have y'all been matched?
6 years.
6 years. That's amazing. So yeah. You were 11.
Yeah.
And this dude who you don't know comes into your life. Like, what was that like? How was your first meeting?
When I first met Dawn, I was this really kind of nerdy, long-haired, shy kid. And I mean, you know, I didn't play any sports. I wasn't active at all. And I had very few friends. And so when my mom said to do this, I was like, I don't know what this is, but if you're signing me up for it, then sure, why not? But when I went to go first meet Dawn, his name is in the Guinness Book of World Records.
For what? Just,
For video games, actually. And back then, my only concern was video games. so when he led with that, I mean, I immediately perked up. And I was like, oh, this guy sounds awesome. And I plan on going into the military. And he was an Army Ranger. So he was in the elite forces. And he was talking about that. So it was almost like a match made in heaven. Everything that I want to aspire to, he already is. So after, like, we started talking and everything just kind of matched up perfectly with us.
Did you know why your mom was, you know, signing you up for Big Brothers, Big Sisters?
She never said it directly to... She hasn't ever said it directly to me ever, but I know exactly why. My dad died when I was at the age of 10. So, and actually, less than a year later is when the next spring is when she signed me up for Big Brothers of Atlanta. Because, you know, I live with all women. I mean, as you said, my mom and my aunt are here.
Which is really nice.
Yeah, and I mean, I have a fantastic family, but I mean, they're all women. I need a guy that I can really rely on and look up to.
A male role model.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that a lot of people have a misconception about the program. It's not necessarily for at-risk youth. I mean, your mom just wanted you to have a role model and a male presence in your life.
Yeah, exactly. And it was actually really funny because today is my friend's 18th birthday, and like a bunch of my friends want to throw this birthday party for him, and it's going on right now. And I was like, oh, I can't make it. I'm going to be in Atlanta. And they were like, oh, what are you in Atlanta for? I was like, well, I'm with the Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Atlanta, and I'm doing this radio thing. And they were like, oh, you're with the Big Brothers. Like, that's so cute. I'm like, well, you guys don't really know what it's about. Dawn and I have become like brothers. I mean, it's incredible what this program does. And I mean, similar to how I was shy and lonely, I think Dawn was also not necessarily shy, but he's kind of got a little lone wolf persona going on. And I mean, I think that him, from where I was before I met Dawn to now where I am with Dawn, I'd say about 95% of who I am can be accredited to what Dawn has done for me. And I think that to see me become someone who went from shy, long-haired, nerdy to someone who's clean-cut, confident, proud of who he is willing to go far, I think him being able to see, like, oh my gosh, I did that for someone who desperately needed that, I think that kind of put in a piece of something that he was missing. I mean, I know that in the future, when I'm Dawn's age, that there's going to be a kid who is 11 years old, whose father just died, and who needs someone to put some structure into his life and to give him some sort of male role model. And, you know, there's always going to be a kid who needs that. Doesn't matter what country you're in, what time period, what dimension you're in, there's always going to be someone who needs someone else, regardless if it's like a husband or a wife or a big brother or a big sister or even a dog. Someone's going to need someone else to love them and to teach them and to kind of guide them through life. So I'm most definitely going to be a part of this program when I'm older.
And you'll do great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the love, it's so well.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Gift of Giving.
Well, I'm from Atlanta. I've been practicing for almost 15 years. I'm an entertainment and IP and art lawyer. And for the last dozen or so, I spent sort of wearing two hats. I was running GLA, Georgia Lawyers for the Arts, serving as executive director. And I also have a private practice, a private entertainment and art law and IP practice, the Moore Firm.
In this notion of giving back, I think helping out artists and supporting their rights and the First Amendment at the top of that is super important.
Oh, absolutely. You know, many times for our artists, no matter how talented they are, the only thing they really have is their intellectual property. So if you have the screenwriter who's written the next great feature film and he inadvertently signs a work for hire so the studio owns it, or, you know, you can use that example and apply to any medium. So you have really talented kids coming out of art schools or just self-taught artists, and nobody has educated them about using the right contracts to protect their copyrights, to protect the revenues derived from their work. And many times once you've signed, you know, for example, the young musician signs a terrible record deal, there's no way to get the kid out of it. I mean, assuming a parent signed if he was under 18 or he's over 18, you know, there's nothing you can do. There's no unconscionability argument. So here he is under contract for the next, what, let's see, six album cycles, which could last 22 years. They don't have to release any product. They don't have to release him. He can't go produce or perform for anybody else. So his whole entire career is now done before it started.
In the spirit of giving back, let's give some free legal advice.
Sure, of course, always.
What do you see as some of the biggest dangers out there in regard to the internet and intellectual property?
Sure. I think that we have a lot of urban legends floating around. I'm not sure who starts them, but I guess I'll go to my grave fighting them. You know, people assume, for example, that something's on the internet, therefore it's fair game, it's in the quote-unquote public domain, they can do whatever they want with it. Obviously, that's not the case. And so we see not only work of our clients, our artists, our creators being ripped off and infringed. Conversely, we see them utilizing other people's works and incorporating them in their own works in a way that maybe it's not permissible. Maybe we can't assert a fair use defense. And so I think the best thing that people can do is, number one, you know, don't be penny wise and pound foolish. You know, spend 5 minutes on the phone with an experienced lawyer that can give you some guidance quickly. I think people are so afraid, oh, I don't want to go hire a lawyer, it's going to be so expensive. I mean, obviously, there are great organizations like GLA. It's a free lawyer. You've got no excuse not to call. And if you can't, you know, if you don't qualify, good for you. Then, you know, spend a little bit of money, a very small investment, to make sure that you're not, you know, running afoul of copyright or trademark or any number of privacy or publicity, any number of state or federal laws that may have interplay.
And protecting yourself.
And protecting yourself. I mean, yeah. Using the right contracts. I think people assume, Gene, that you can pull any type of agreement off the internet. You know, like there's one contract for all purposes. Well, maybe you do need a production agreement, but maybe the one you pulled off the internet is, number one, drafted to be very favorable to the other side, or wasn't even drafted by an experienced lawyer.
Let me ask you this, because I want to... One thing that I've heard, and I've had a couple of interesting conversations with guests from this show, pretty prominent artists, and they've talked about how the gallery is antiquated, and that a lot of times the way that a gallery can make money is through event rental, and you've got this beautiful art on the wall, but is that just decoration, or are you really trying to sell it? Is there a future where if you're going to be renting these galleries for event space, that the artists can be compensated, you know, proportionally for what they've contributed?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, you should be a lawyer, Gene. You should be a visual arts lawyer. I mean, that's not happening now. And I really wonder how many people that actually rent galleries out for weddings or receptions or corporate parties actually even notice the art on the wall. But, you know, it would be great. I think the challenge is that the whole nature of the art world is changing. I mean, I think art sales have sort of fallen off cliff. And we in our practice represent a lot of visual artists, but we also represent a lot of great galleries in town, like Jackson Fine Art or Rob Matre's Gallery, a lot of top-tier galleries. I think the challenge is that less and less we're seeing collectors, number one, buying art, and number two, when they are, they're getting on a plane and going to Miami for the art fairs, or they're going to international fairs. And it's almost like we have these sort of these destination art malls, if you will, and the role of the traditional gallery is changing tremendously. They're not quite the intermediary that they were once between the consumer and the artist. And so it's a problem for galleries.
Thank you so much for joining.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Gene. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Don Mahler, Janice McKenzie Creighton, David Axford, and Lisa Moore. Of course, we'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Thanks so much for listening. See you next month. This show is dedicated to the memory of Ellen Stitch Newell, a loving wife, sister, aunt, and friend. Her greatest gift was giving of herself to others through her steadfast support and genuine interest in their lives. Everyone was Ellen's best friend. She was greatly loved. She'll be dearly missed.